All right. And as I said, I just want to very quickly review the first part of the first several verses of the chapter. This chapter 18, the vision cycle that had begun some chapters earlier continues. And in this particular part of the cycle, we see the portrayal of the fall and total destruction of what is called Babylon the Great. And in the first three verses, I'm not going to take the time to read them just again in the interest of time, because we have many other verses that I do want to call your attention to. We see this statement in verse 2, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean bird. Now, I have tried to make the case to you throughout this class, where the occasions have made it obvious, in my opinion at least, that the reference here to Babylon, the great city, in previous chapter, I believe chapter 11, we saw the reference to the great city, Sodom and Egypt, that all of these are metaphorical or symbolic references to the city of Jerusalem as it existed at that time. And I have adduced what I think is a mountain of biblical evidence to support that claim and that statement, one of which is Isaiah 29, where, again, and to remind you that in these Old Testament references, what we're seeing in the Old Covenant references in places like Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah is the prophets at that time were talking about God's wrath and judgment coming upon the people of Israel and specifically the city of Jerusalem. Why? Well, because they had fallen into apostasy. They had turned their backs on God's teachings and God's word. And they had given themselves over to the worship of false gods. They had given themselves over to materialism. And so we read things, as in Isaiah 21, and he answered, 21 verse 9, fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the carved images of her gods he has shattered to the ground. And then after that statement, in Isaiah 21, there follows the highly symbolic description of demons and foul spirits, and also in Revelation 18, by the way, and unclean birds infesting the city. And this is further symbolic or metaphorical speech used to describe the awful spiritual condition into which the city of Jerusalem had fallen by the middle of the first century. And we see similar language where Jesus himself spoke in Matthew 12 in talking about a parable. He said, and speaking a parable, he says, when an unclean, this is Matthew 12, 43 to 45, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest and finds none. Then he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. And then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself. They enter and dwell there, and the last state of the man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation. Now, the last line there very clearly delineates where and whom Jesus was talking about. The people of that generation, the people of Israel and the city of Jerusalem at that time. And he's looking back to the first house cleaning, if you will, where God caused the destruction of the city, and the enslavement of the people who were carried off into slavery by the Babylonians and the Assyrians. And now, and in using that kind of illustration, he's saying, it's gotten worse than the previous time. Because it's not only that you have turned your back on God's law and that you have given yourself over to the worship of false gods and you've given yourself over to materialism. Now you've even come to the point when the Messiah comes, you're going to put him to death. That's far worse than anything that you did in the time of your forefathers. Or, if anything, it's sort of the capstone, the culmination of that. And then I gave you that that study note reference in Matthew 12 from the Reformation Study Bible, and I made the point that while it certainly has personal application to the individual reader, it totally misses the social and political context in which Jesus spoke the parable. There's no reference there whatever in that study note in the Reformation Study Bible to the highly charged political and civil situation in which Jesus was working and ministering. Now, in Luke chapter 23, I pointed out to you how the reference to when he says, so shall it be with this wicked generation. He has reference there to some very specific things that were going on. And as I've said, the people of Israel had turned their backs on God. And one of the ways that they had done that, especially in their complicity, the leaders of the Jews, in their complicity for the facilitating of the execution and the removal of Jesus, was by making common cause with the pagan Romans. And I gave you this this reference to what I would call a military or political fornication in Luke chapter 23, beginning at verse 6. When Pilate heard this, that is, when he heard that Jesus was supposed to be the king of the Jews and that Herod, was the king of the Jews, politically speaking, he asked whether the man was a Galilean, and when he learned, meaning Jesus, and when he learned that he was from Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod. Herod examines him and roughs him up and sends him back to Pilate. And then we read this very telling statement in verse 12 of Luke 23. That very day, Herod, king of the Jews, the political representative of the people of Israel, and Pilate, who was the official government representative of Rome in that area, became friends with each other, it says, for prior to this, they had been enemies. What was it that brought them together? It was their common cause in opposing God's covenant and opposing the Messiah of God. Now, in addition to military and political infidelity, verse 3 of chapter 18 also mentions what may be termed commercial prostitution. In ancient as well as in modern commerce, trade, and the accumulation of wealth, those things have been powerfully tempting things to lead people away from godliness. And in the immediate context of the verses, the incident between Jesus and the money changers in the temple would be a symbolic representation of the problem that existed in the city of Jerusalem at that time. As I've written on the board, Jerusalem was an immensely wealthy city. We'll have occasion to come back to that point a little bit toward the end of the presentation. But you have to keep in mind that this was not only an immensely large city with upwards of 1 million or more inhabitants. It also was a city of great commerce and trade, not to mention the fact that it continually was a place, even as it is today, where people were making religious pilgrimages. People had to offer sacrifices and do all these sorts of things, so there was a brisk trade, just like if you go to the city of Rome or the city of Bethlehem. Anybody ever been to Rome here? You've been to Bethlehem? Anybody been to Bethlehem? You got all the shops where you can buy these crosses and crucifixes and all these sorts of things. Would you go back and ask them to be quiet? And so the city of Jerusalem was the same way at that time. It was a place of great commerce and great wealth. Hosea 12:7 in the Old Covenant makes the same reference to the problem at that time. The people are like crafty merchants selling from dishonest scales. They love to cheat. And then in chapter 18, verses 4 to 5, we read, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." Now, since the earliest followers of Jesus were Jews, there was a great struggle on their part to be fully separated from the Judaism of the day. And God, you see, was taking the covenantal religion that he established with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he was taking it to the next level. And the prophets of old foretold the coming of this day when a new and better covenant was coming. And that time had dawned, you see. And that was the problem that the people of the leaders of Israel, especially the religious leaders, they were expecting it to come at the end. Well, what they had to deal with was the fact that the end had come. That which was projected far into the future had broken in and was now dawning in their age. And they were sorely unprepared to deal with it. Now, the author of Revelation hears this voice, which is a clarion call for the followers of Jesus to separate themselves or to come out of the city. And as I mentioned last week, and this is again all by way of review at this point, this call for separation was not only a call in terms of separating yourself from that which will compromise your religious faith, the true faith in Jesus as the Messiah. But it was also literally a call to physically vacate the place because of what was about to happen to it. The concern here is that the followers of Jesus avoid the destruction that was coming, and only by coming out of her, both spiritually and physically, could they hope to avoid that destruction. And then I gave you this interesting exhortation that we find in Hebrews 13, 12 to 14. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach, for we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. Now that is a very powerful statement in terms of the shift in God's covenantal program and the way God was administering salvation and redemption to people in the world. There was no longer to be a central city. And in the case of Jerusalem, where God's presence would dwell in a unique way. Those days were over. Why? Because with the coming of the Holy Spirit, God's dwelling place, as foretold by the prophets, was in the lives and hearts of his people. Now, we also read here in verses 5 and 6, the author indicates that the sins of Jerusalem, Babylon, I'm equating the two for the reasons I've already explained, have now come to the level of guaranteeing that God's wrath must fall upon it. And now I think we come up to about where we left off. In 5 and 6, for her sins, Revelation 18, 5 to 6, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works, and the cup which she has mixed double for her. Now, there is a direct connection with these verses with the city of Jerusalem. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 51, Jeremiah 51, verses 6 to 9. Jeremiah 51, verses 6 to 9. Jeremiah 51, verses 6 to 9. Flee from the midst of Babylon, and everyone save his life. Do not be cut off in her iniquity, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He shall recompense her. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunk. The nations drank her wine. Therefore the nations are deranged. Babylon has suddenly fallen and been destroyed. Wail for her. Take balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. We would have healed Babylon, but she is not healed. Forsake her, and let us go everyone to his own country, for her judgment reaches to heaven and is lifted up to the skies. This is essentially the same language and concept that we see in Revelation 18, 5 and 6. Just as the sins of Babylon reached the level wherein God's wrath was triggered, so too does now Jerusalem, having become another Babylon, bring the same judgment upon herself. Now the action or the imagery there of remembering, and I pose this in a question, what happens when God remembers? Well, covenantally speaking, biblically speaking, when God remembers you, you better watch out. Because either you're in for a tremendous blessing or a tremendous cursing. That kind of language is frequently associated in Scripture with covenantal acts of God toward his people or toward his or their enemies. Now, I'm not going to read these. And I neglected to write them on the board, but let me mention them. Genesis 8:1, Genesis 19:29, Genesis 30:22, Exodus 2:24. Genesis 8:1, Genesis 19:29, Genesis 30:22, and Exodus 2:24. You will find in all of those passages examples, and the wording itself is used, of God remembering his covenant or remembering this, and it's directly tied to either a judgment coming upon his or the people's enemies or a blessing coming upon one of God's people. God's law prescribes proper blessing or cursing in direct proportion to obedience or disobedience. And in this case, the sins of apostate Israel have been twice as bad as anything previously, in a manner of speaking, and so her punishment will be doubled. Yes, Jerusalem had been destroyed before, but the temple and the city had been restored. That wasn't going to happen after this case. With verse 7, the theme of Jerusalem, Babylon, or Jerusalem as Babylon, continues with a description that clearly calls to mind the words of the prophet Isaiah. Somebody read Revelation 18:7. Can I have somebody to read that verse, please? Tom? Now, in Isaiah 47:5-8, I'm reading from the New Living Translation. We read the following. God, through the prophet, is speaking in his time of the wickedness and impending judgment upon the then city of Babylon. And he writes this way, O daughter of Babylonia, sit now in darkness and silence. Never again will you be known as the queen of kingdoms. You see the reference. I sit as a queen. Revelation 18:7, Isaiah saying, you will never sit as a queen. You thought, I will reign forever as queen of the world. You did not care at all about my people or think about the consequences of your actions. You are a pleasure-crazy kingdom, living at ease and feeling secure, bragging as if you were the greatest in the world. You say, I'm self-sufficient and not accountable to anyone. I will never be a widow or lose my children, end quote. Jerusalem, in the time of Jesus, was a city run by men who at once fancied themselves and their kingdom as the wife or the bride of God Almighty, and therefore immune to total defeat or subjugation. The truth was, from God's standpoint, that by rejecting the Messiah, they had divorced themselves from the true God and had become the adulterous handmaiden of the Roman Caesar Nero. Now, verse 8 of Revelation 18 speaks there, can I have someone read there, about the plagues in one day? Now, Joy? Thank you. Now, the idea here is to convey the suddenness, to convey to the reader the suddenness, not the literal timing of the coming destruction. And as to the various ways in which the judgment of God would break upon Jerusalem, this verse also refers to her being burned with fire. Now, in the Old Covenant, again, this is another example where if you are coming to the book of Revelation with nothing to back you up in your study than the words of Tim LaHaye and Jerry Falwell or whoever else it is, you're going to miss this. This won't be obvious to you. But if you come with the words of God in Scripture to back you up, you see all of this very plainly. It's quite remarkable the way this works out. In the Old Covenant, you see, burning with fire was the standard and terrible punishment for adultery, for fornication. But more than that, it was specifically the punishment for the daughter of a priest convicted of those crimes. Turn to Leviticus 21, verse 9. Leviticus 21, verse 9. I'd like a volunteer to read that, please. Leviticus 21, verse 9. Don? Thank you. What translation is that? New King James. Let me read it to you in two other translations. NIV, if a priest's daughter defiles herself by becoming a prostitute, she disgraces her father, she must be burned in the fire. You see, you've got several different types of imagery taking place simultaneously here in the case of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was at once the daughter, the bride, the crown jewel of God's eye. Leviticus 21:9 in the ESV, and the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by whoring, profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. And as attested in the following quotes from the writings of Josephus, famine, plague, and fire were all contributing factors to the eventual fall and destruction of Jerusalem. Let me read some of this to you. I've tried to somewhat esoterically list it on the board for you. This is from the works of Josephus, his book, The Wars of the Jews. He writes, so all hope of escaping was now cut off from the Jews, together with their liberty of going out of the city. This is at the time of the Roman siege and attack in AD 66 to 70. Then did the famine widen its progress and devoured the people by whole houses and families. The upper rooms were full of women and children that were dying by famine, and the lanes of the city were full of the dead bodies of the aged. The children also and the young men wandered about the marketplaces like shadows, all swelled with the famine. In other words, their bodies were bloated because they weren't getting the right kind of nutrition, and fell down dead wheresoever their misery seized them. As for burying them, those that were sick themselves were not able to do it, and those that were hearty and well were deterred from doing it by the great multitude of those dead bodies, and by the uncertainty there was how soon they should die themselves. For many died as they were burying others, and many went to their coffins before that fatal hour was come. In other words, I presume some actually were buried alive. Nor was there any lamentation made under these calamities, nor were heard any mournful complaints. But the famine confounded all natural passions, for those who were just going to die looked upon those that were gone to rest before them with dry eyes and open mouths. A deep silence also, and a kind of deadly night, had seized upon the city, while yet the robbers were still more terrible than these miseries were themselves, for they broke open the houses which were no other than the graves of dead bodies, and plundered them of what they had, and carrying off the coverings of their bodies, went out laughing, and tried the points of their swords in the dead bodies. And in order to prove what metal they were made of, they thrust some of those through that still lay alive upon the ground. But for those that entreated them to lend them their right hand and their sword to dispatch them, they were too proud to grant their request and left them to be consumed by famine. Now every one of these died with their eyes fixed upon the temple and left the seditious alive behind them. Now the seditious, that's a certain faction within the city of Jerusalem at the time among the Jews, the seditious faction. Now the seditious at first gave orders that the dead should be buried out of the public treasury, as not enduring the stench of their dead bodies, but afterwards, when they could not do that, they cast them down from the walls into the valleys beneath. However, when Titus, that's the Roman general, in going his rounds along these valleys, saw them full of dead bodies and the thick putrefaction running about them, he gave a groan, and spreading out his hands to heaven, called God to witness that this was not his doing, and as such, the sad case of the city itself. Now, of those that perished by famine in the city, the number was prodigious, and the miseries they underwent were unspeakable. And he goes on about this in some great detail, which I'll spare you the gory details about that. So, at any rate, we not only have this prediction and revelation of what would then be a future coming destruction upon Israel, but we see the fulfillment of it in the writings of Josephus as he gave a chronicle of what actually happened in that time. Now, verses 11 to 18, let's look at Revelation 18, verses 11 to 18. And the merchants of the earth, or the land, let's remember the Greek word geis there. I have made the case to you on previous occasions, and most of these incidents refers to the land of Israel, not the entire earth. The merchants of the land will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones, etc. It goes into a lot of detail there. And verse 15, the merchants of these things who become rich by her, who became rich by her, will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is like this great city? Now, verses 11 through 18, along with verses 9 to 10, speak of the misery and sorrow that will come upon the kings of the land, or the chiefs of the land, who will have been financially, socially, or politically impacted by the utter devastation that was to come upon the city of Jerusalem. Now, we have had in our lifetime a similar misery factor that was very evident in New York City following the destruction of the two towers, the World Trade Center. The negative impact of that one event, which was far more than just destroying a couple of buildings in New York City. It was felt, and is still felt, in a myriad of ways, and it can therefore be more easily appreciated what would have been the devastating consequences for commerce, for trade, and the general running of society when a city as large and as important as Jerusalem was totally annihilated. And it's to be noted that a large part of the trade that took place in and around Jerusalem, along with the what we might call tourist trade of the day, associated, as I've already said, with pilgrimages to the city and to the temple, that trade was largely facilitated by the shipping industry. Now, the wording of verse 18, wherein the city's fall is bemoaned by merchants and the socialites of the day, what is like this great city? And the New Jerusalem Bible has it, has there ever been a city as great as this? Now, that's taken directly from Ezekiel chapters 26 and 27, where the prophet speaks in detail of the downfall of the great city of Tyre, T-Y-R-E, Tyre. And although the author of Revelation does not explicitly make that comparison, it is here implied, at least, that Jerusalem has become like Tyre, a city known for its opulent wealth and desire for more and more riches. In Ezekiel 27:32, we read, "In their wailing for you, they will take up lamentation and lament for you. What city is like Tyre, destroyed in the midst of the sea?" What city is like this city of Tyre? The same words that are put into the mouths of the people who will be lamenting the fall of Jerusalem. Now, the closing verses of chapter 18, verses 21 to 24, we read as follows. "Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence the great city of Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found any more." By the way, let me ask you, where do you come across that kind of imagery in the Bible of a millstone being put around someone's neck? Joy? Yes. He says it would be better for that person who would prevent one of these little ones from coming to believe in him and follow him, that they just be tied up and thrown into the ocean or to the lake and drown. What an interesting wording here we have, because that's exactly what the leaders of Jerusalem were doing in this time. They were preventing the people of Israel from following their true Messiah. The sound of harpists, verse 22, musicians, flutists, I guess that should probably be flautists, shouldn't it? And trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore. The sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived, and in her was found the blood of the prophets and saints and all who were slain on the earth or the land. Now, as we have seen in many places in the apocalypse, symbolic and metaphorical language is used here to speak of immense destruction and disruption. And it must also be kept in mind that this language also describes events that literally took place. So we're constantly dealing with this interplay between metaphorical descriptions that were not meant to be taken literally in a sense of, well, in one day this is going to happen. Or you see this gigantic figure standing with a flaming sword. But in another sense, it is meant to be taken literally in that it was speaking of things that would literally take place. We read in the Wars of the Jews, Book 7, Chapter 1, Part 1, the book by Josephus. Now, as soon as the army had no more people, now this is what was going on in the city of Jerusalem, I believe, after the Romans had already gotten inside the city. because there remained none to be the objects of their fury, for they would not have spared any had there remained any other work to be done, Caesar gave orders that they should now get this now, demolish the entire city and the temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as were of the greatest eminency. That is, and he lists the names of the towers. And so much of the wall as enclosed the city on the west side. This wall was spared in order to afford a camp for such as were to lie in garrison, as were the towers also spared in order to demonstrate to posterity what kind of city it was and how well fortified, which the Roman valor had subdued. But for all the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid, even with the ground by those who dug it up to the foundation, that there was nothing to make those that came hither believe it had ever been inhabited. This was the end which Jerusalem came to by the madness of those that were for innovations, a city otherwise of great magnificence and of mighty fame among all mankind. In other words, he's saying, they totally took this city apart piece by piece. They dug up the foundations of the buildings. They left some things standing, but this was a testament to Roman power that you cross us and this is what will happen to you. We will wipe you off the face of the earth with no memory left. People will come here and say, did anybody ever actually live in this place? How could they have ever lived here? Now, let's look at verse 24 of Revelation 18. This is a very key verse. And in her, this great city of Babylon, was found the blood of the prophets and saints and all who were slain on the land or on the earth. And you see, that's a very key verse because nothing like that could possibly be said of the ancient city of Babylon or a revived city of Babylon or the city of Rome or the Roman Catholic Church or all the other candidates that our futurist friends want to say this is talking about. Jerusalem alone was guilty of the blood of the prophets and martyrs and the apostles and the saints. How do we know that? Well, Jesus himself said in Matthew 23:29-36, and I won't read all of that passage. Well, excuse me, I guess I will, because I've got it in several different key translations here, especially verse 36. He says here, in truth, I'm getting way ahead of myself. Let me start with verse 29. Alas for you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. This is Jesus now speaking to the leaders of Israel. You build the sepulchres of the prophets and decorate the tombs of the upright, saying, we would never have joined in the shedding of blood of the prophets had we lived in the days of our ancestors. So, he says, your own evidence tells against you. You are the children of those who murdered the prophets. Very well, then, finish off the work that your ancestors began. You serpents, brood of vipers, this is why I'm sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some you will slaughter and crucify. Some you will scourge in your own synagogues. And so you will draw on yourselves the blood of every upright person that has been shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah. In truth, now notice verse 36, I tell you, now this is from the New Jerusalem Bible translation, the way they have it, it will all recoil upon this generation. The New English translation, this generation will be held responsible for all of these things. And then we have an interesting another passage in Acts 7. I believe this is Stephen speaking, if I'm not mistaken. You stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in your hearts and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? Okay, picking up where I left off, if I left myself. The key point there is that Jesus had already said these things were going to come upon that generation. He talked about how these people were, the leaders of Israel were guilty of these very things. And in Jeremiah 51:41-49, the prophet there, in talking about the ancient nation of Babylon, he talked about how God's wrath was going to come upon ancient Babylon because they were shedding the blood of the prophets and the people, the covenant people of God. And in verse 49, Jeremiah 51:49, as Babylon has caused the slain of Israel to fall, so at Babylon on the slain of all the earth shall fall. Or in the New Living Translation, just as Babylon killed the people of Israel and others throughout the world, so must her people kill.
And what was then this transitional age between the closing down of the Old Testament era and the establishing of the new, God would now exact his vengeance against Jerusalem for spilling the innocent blood of the followers of Jesus. Now, that concludes with that unfortunate interlude, the study in chapter 18. I do want to just take a very quick moment to mention something to you that I found in the interim from the last time that we were in this study together before the summer program began. There's an article published in some obscure journal or other. I found this on a website where the author, it might have actually been a modern military journal, but the author of the journal had gone into some detail in researching how the Roman army accomplished the attack and destruction of the city of Jerusalem. And it was fascinating to read because it really highlighted some things that we had not known before about the way that the Roman legions functioned. And I thought you might find this of some interest. It's been a while since I read it, but I think I can reconstruct some of the key points. Because in some ways it's kind of comical, but it shows, you know, our tendency, I think, to sort of get this mythologized, almost unreal view about the way people were back then. What he was saying was that the legions were typically divided up into two categories. And I don't remember the terms that we used, but you had the fighting men, you know, the Maximus type guys from the movie Gladiator. And, you know, they were well respected and they were very strong and powerful warriors. But then you had another faction among the legionnaires whose job was labor. I mean, these were the guys that built the mounds that they could, you know, bring up to the walls of the city so the warriors could get in there. They're the ones who would dig the trenches. They were the ones who would construct the catapults and do all these things. And they sort of fostered this competition. You know, it's like they had different committees who would do these things among the two groups and also within the groups themselves, the laborers and the fighters. And it was almost like a guild or a lodge where they were very dedicated to their particular group and they were constantly trying to get ahead of each other. I mean, it was, you know, very friendly competition, but it was very fierce competition. And they knew there were great rewards and blessings for being better at this particular thing or the other. So that was a fascinating thing that I had never heard before. One of the ways they were so efficient is that they had constructed that kind of social structure among their military. Now the other thing was is that the way some of the military parties themselves were able to accomplish some of these things. On one occasion, there was a main section of the city of Jerusalem where the Romans had tried repeatedly to breach it, but they couldn't. Well, one night, apparently, there was a group of men, they were all soldiers, and they were sort of on guard duty, and one of them said, I'm paraphrasing here, but this is essentially what happened. Why don't we see if we can take this thing instead? So they all get together, they grab a few guys, and one of the most important things that they said, they had to get the guy with the standard, you know, the insignia of their particular legion. And they went and they actually did it. I mean, and so somebody had to run back and tell Titus and the rest, we got in there, come on, let's go. And so they woke up and they all charged in there and made a major incursion into the city. But they had basically disobeyed orders. I mean, Titus hadn't told them, okay, go try to do this. But that was one of the ways that they gained great success in attacking. Well, anyway, I think our time is about up.